Thank you. Be seated.
Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioners in CMH Homes versus Dan.
May it please the court, Mr. Douglas Alexander will present arguments for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This is an invitee premises liability case in which this court should reverse and render judgment that the plaintiff take nothing. That result is compelled as a matter of law because the plaintiff failed to carry his threshold burden of proof with respect to the elements of duty. More particularly, the plaintiff failed to adduce evidence that either, one, that the defendant caused the instability in the steps, that the plaintiff say caused his injury, or two, that the defendant actually knew that the steps in question had become unstable, or three, that the steps had been unstable long enough to give the defendant a reasonable opportunity to discover that condition. Now, in the face of that absence of proof, what the plaintiff has effectively done is to shift the focus of inquiry. And what the plaintiff effectively argues is that the dangerous condition here for purposes of the duty analysis is not the instability that developed in the steps, but rather the steps themselves. What the plaintiff argues is that based upon its experience with previous steps, that the defendant here knew or should have known that these steps would inevitably wear out or sustain damage at some time in the future. Now, there's three fundamental flaws with that argument. The first one is that that argument asks us to assume that the steps upon which the plaintiff was injured were effectively of the same construction as the previous steps with which they had experience. And the evidence simply does not support that theory. Number two, the steps here, if we focus on them as the dangerous condition, do not meet the exacting definition of, and this is a term of art, unreasonable risk of harm for purposes of the duty analysis. And number three, if we go down the road of focusing on the steps as the purported dangerous condition, there is a total shortcoming in proof with respect to the breach elements of a premises liability claim.
What evidence was there that the defendant knew the steps would wear out or could wear out?
The evidence that the defendant knew that steps could wear out was that the defendant had previously placed other steps. What type of steps, we do not know. The evidence is not there. On the premises, and that over a period of time, and the only time frame we have in the record, and it's on pages 96 and 97 of the record, is that over a period of perhaps 12 to 15 months, the steps would begin to move, at which time they would either be repaired or disposed of and replaced.
We don't know if those steps used in the past were the same as the steps at issue in this case.
That is correct. What we do know is the steps in this case, at least the best evidence we have of that, actually comes from the plaintiff's own supervisor and the plaintiff himself. And the description of the steps is that they were metal framed and braced steps in which the only portion made of wood was the actual tread where one places one's foot on the steps. We don't know, because the record doesn't tell us, what the previous steps were constructed of. The suggestion is that they are wooden, but we don't. That's the gap.
How long were the steps there before the incident?
That, too, we do not know.
And is there any evidence in the record indicating whether or not the steps were damaged in any way by the plaintiff's truck backing up into the steps?
No. There's no evidence of that. What we have is, what we have is an incident where there was no witnesses. We're obviously compelled by the standard of review to accept the plaintiff's testimony that these steps were unstable when he stepped on them. But we do not know how they became unstable. We do not know when they became unstable. Now, to assist with the argument, I prepared some oral argument exhibits, and I can just go ahead and dive into those. Under tab 1, are the four elements of a premises liability case, and I think they're relatively uncontroversial. These are the same four elements that we see in Corbin, a case, the Keach versus Kroger case, Walmart versus Gonzalez, Motel 6 versus Lopez. The additions that I've made to it is some of the drawings out to the right. I suggest that the first two elements are duty elements, and elements 3 and 4 are breach elements. Now this court has never expressly stated that in so many words, but that is the clear message that we get, for instance, from the Motel 6 versus Lopez case, which I have quoted at the bottom. Now, the reason that 3 and 4 is shaded is the point there is that unless you carry your threshold burden of proof with respect to the duty elements, which are questions of law, you don't even get to breach. And that's what Motel 6 versus Lopez makes clear. Now, if you turn to tab 2, what I have done there is...
Mr. Alexander, you just said that both the elements of the duty question, or the duty question itself is a question of law.
Correct.
But the underlying pieces of it, whether or not there was actual or constructive notice, in fact, could be fact issues. Correct?
Well, they can be fact issue, and Keach versus Kroger is the case to look to on that. In other words, what you first have to do, the court, as an initial matter, determines whether the plaintiff has satisfied, gets over the threshold to the point where we can submit it to the jury.
Well, we don't have any question that we have an invitee here.
Correct.
And that this particular landowner owed the duty that the law requires to an invitee.
That is right. Okay.
So our threshold legal question has been answered.
Okay. Well, and this is let me back up and put it that way. Right. We know that this is an invitee case. But what the court has consistently said in its opinions is, in order to determine whether a duty has been triggered, you have to satisfy these two first two elements. And the way that that's typically been done, if you turn to number two, is you have to first show that and I'm talking about the typical case, which I say this case is, you have to demonstrate that the defendant had actual or constructive knowledge of the specific hazard that caused the plaintiff's injury. If you look at Walmart...
And a defendant can come in and say, I didn't know about this, and the plaintiff can put on proof that says, I do, assuming there is a hazard. And,
okay.
And a fact issue then arises on whether or not there's notice. There was notice.
If what? What triggers a fact issue?
The defendant comes in and says, I didn't know about this condition.
Right.
And the plaintiff says, here's proof that you did know.
Correct.
So there are underlying factual issues as part
right.
of the way you've laid this out.
Correct. And a case to look to on that, I think that the way to understand that is if you look at the Centec Realty case, it's 899 Southwest 2nd 195 at 197. That's a decision by this court. And the court says the existence of duty is a question of law for the court to decide from the facts surrounding the occurrence in question. In other words, in making the threshold determination of duty, which is a question of law, you don't put on blinders and say, I'm not going to look at the facts. You do look at the facts.
And sometimes there are fact findings that have to be made before the determination could be made of whether the duty has arisen, as you've laid out this.
Right. And I'll give an example of that. I mean, Corbin was one, there was a disputed issue of facts as to whether a mat was in place. But in our case, and again, if we look at number two, in the typical case, you have to have actual constructive knowledge of the specific hazard. I mean, example. And when we talk about specific hazard, it's the puddle on the floor. It's not the leaky roof. It's the bent and defective condition of the carts. It's not the carts themselves. In the Walmart v. Gonzalez case, it's the macaroni salad on the floor, not sale on the premise.
Then I'm confused about how you started off your argument. You said that the plaintiff was focusing on the instability in the steps, not the steps themselves. And now I'm hearing a contradiction in what you're saying, that what we need to look to is the defect or alleged defect in the steps,
okay.
And that's the instability.
If I suggested that the plaintiff is arguing that you that focus on the instability, then I misspoke. Okay. What I am saying is that in the typical analysis, which this is, you do focus here on the instability in the steps because that is the specific hazard. You ask whether there is actual or constructive knowledge of that. What they have essentially done, the plaintiff has done, is to argue, and let me make that clear, they're now trying to argue, no, we don't have to do that. We're not bound by Walmart v. Gonzalez. We do not have to show actual or constructive knowledge of the specific hazard because our case is a Corbin case. It's a Corbin case in which the steps themselves constitute the unreasonably dangerous condition. And what I'm suggesting to you is this is not a Corbin case. This is not the exceptional case that gets us there, and under tab 3 I'll explain some of that.
Well, they also argue, they say that they're not relying on Gonzalez because Gonzalez is a constructive notice case, and they're not concerned about constructive notice here. They're looking at actual notice, the way I understand their brief.
Yes, but actual notice of what?
You said actual notice of the instability in the step.
Okay, and they're not, there is no evidence. They're not saying that there is actual notice of the instability of the steps.
They're not saying that.
And let me explain that very carefully. They are not, they have no proof that the defendant here actually knew that the steps had become unstable. Okay. At this time, they have no proof that the defendant caused the steps to become unstable. They have no proof as to how long they were unstable. Under Walmart v. Gonzalez, that concludes the inquiry. So what they have done is...
Yeah, respond to their argument specifically, and I may be misunderstanding it. You all are splitting some real fine
hairs. I understand.
Here, very
absolutely.
They understand that they say that the defendant knew that the stairs could become unstable at any point in time, and therefore they had stairs that created a hazard, and that's what your client had actual notice of, which is the hazard. Stairs that you couldn't count on to stay stable. Now, why doesn't, in your outline, doesn't that mean that, now, but I don't know if I split the hairs the right way.
No, you split it exactly the right way.
I'd like to hear your response to that.
Flip to tab three. Tab three is the Corbin case. Corbin is the case that says, and this is the anomaly that we have in the case law. Under Walmart v. Gonzalez, we know that there had to be proof as to how long this piece of food was on the floor. In Corbin, we know that this court said, well, they don't have to show how long this piece of food was on the floor. That's an anomaly. And the question becomes, why is that? And the difference is because, and it's stated at the top, in the atypical case, when we talk about the dangerous condition, it can be the man-made object or the mode of operation that gives rise to the specific hazard, if you fit, okay? And the key here is the big if. This case doesn't fit. Why? In order for that type of situation to arise, you have to look at the test. The kind of the defining difference here is the phrase unreasonable risk of harm. The key case on that is a decision by Chief Justice Calvert in Seidenick, which is cited here. And what you have to show, if you're trying to squeeze yourself into a Corbin case, is this man-made object itself is unreasonably dangerous. Now, why was it unreasonably dangerous in Corbin? Well, because there was a showing that unless you had a protective mat in place, grapes were falling all the time. There was no opportunity whatsoever to reasonably police that. It was so frequent that periodic inspection could not reduce the risk of harm. And some of the factors, and that's what they're trying to do. I mean, and you talk about it splitting hairs. It is very much a splitting hairs case. It's a case that causes you to rub your head when you look at some of the case law because it's confusing. But that's what they're trying to do, is to bring themselves into a situation where they say, based upon the previous experience with steps, manufacturer type, we don't know, this is a Corbin situation, and it's not.
Mr. Alexander,
yes.
With your remaining time, can you just talk a minute about venue, why venue is not appropriate here in Montgomery?
Okay. I really don't have much to add to what we've already in our brief, but it really boils down to this. In Ford versus Miles, this court clearly articulated that the test for venue, when you're relying upon an agent or representative, which they are here, is broad power to act on behalf of the corporation. Here, fortunately, the record with respect to venue is relatively short. We say that what the record demonstrates here is that the purported agent's power was actually circumscribed. It was limited, and that individual did not have, far from having broad power to act on behalf of the corporation, that power was limited. I see I have the red light.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Fowler.
May it please the court. Mr. William Powers, Jr. will present argument for the respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'd like to begin by following up on Justice Hankinson's question and focusing on what it is that we are claiming is the dangerous premises condition in this case. And I don't think it's splitting hairs at all. We're claiming that the steps were improperly designed for the use to which they were put and, as you put it, Your Honor, couldn't be counted on. They were going to become stable, inevitably.
Let me ask you about that. Were they unreasonably dangerous when they were installed?
Yes, we think they were unreasonably dangerous when they were installed.
Because
they were used in a setting where CMH knew there were heavy deliveries frequently used, and these were steps that are designed to be used in a temporary setting to get in and out of mobile homes before somebody puts a deck or a porch or something around their mobile home. It was like if Sears had a heavy loading dock. And instead of having permanent steps that would last, they simply put up some temporary steps that they knew inevitably would become unstable and
what was the evidence about these particular steps? How long did it take them to become unstable?
Okay, the testimony from the supervisor, Mr. Mason, and the two workers, Mr. Flores and Mr. Gonzalez, was it was their regular practice to just let the step become unstable. They testified they knew when they became unstable that they were dangerous.
How long did it take for them to become unstable?
Mr. Flores testified he replaced them about every 12 to 15 months. They also were placed in a position where they could get hit by trucks, in which case that would be more frequently, and the trucks would make them become unstable. Sometimes trucks driven by Mr. Flores, sometimes trucks driven by people making deliveries.
If the steps were never hit by a truck, would they still be unreasonably dangerous?
Yes, because they were flimsy. As Justice Hankinson put it, they couldn't be counted upon to bear these kinds of loads.
What evidence were there that the particular steps that were there on the day of the injury were the, quote, flimsy, unquote, steps that had to be replaced every 12 to 15 months in the past?
Well, Mr. Flores and Mr. Mason and Mr. Gonzalez testified about their regular practice. This is what they did. Now, after the accident, they replaced them by all metal steps. They haven't had any problems or instability in, I think it's the 3.5 years between the accident and the trial. And their testimony was, this is the way we did it. Now, I think it's a reasonable inference that when they testified, this is the way we did it, that was a regular practice. And that when they were referring to these steps would inevitably become unstable, that was the condition prior to this accident.
Why doesn't your standard make anybody that's open for business an insurer of all the equipment there, unless they've brought the very finest piece of equipment?
Well, there are two reasons. First, the knowledge requirement means that they're not an insurer. Right? The knowledge requirement, by the way, is to make sure that they have a chance to do something about it.
But we have lots of things. There are lots of things in our society that wear out on an infrequent but certain basis, 2 years, 5 years.
That's correct. But the knowledge requirement, they have to know about that, or with reasonable diligence should have known about it. But then all they have to do is then take reasonable precautions. Every negligence case is like that. Every negligence case, the only way to absolutely avoid injury, whether it's driving an automobile or building steps or premises liability, in any negligence case, the only way to absolutely avoid any liability, any injury is perfection. That's not what the law requires. All the law requires is reasonable precaution,
and
a reasonably safe step.
That would include inspections, I take it. I
mean, well, it would include inspections.
You can discharge your duty in most premises cases by frequent inspection.
That would be correct, but
what evidence was there that they didn't frequently inspect here?
Well, they could discharge their, well, it's not, we could claim that they should have done a number of things that were unreasonable to have to have caused the accident. What we claim they did unreasonable is use shoddy steps.
But yet, but either they have to, is the use of these kind of steps that can wear out 12 to 15 months or sooner if hit by a truck, would that be enough, regardless of what else they did? I mean, if you use that, that's enough to establish
liability. Well, if they wanted to come in with evidence that their conduct was reasonable, they could try to convince the jury that using these steps with a certain frequency of inspections was reasonable. That goes to the breach issue. But certainly the jury was entitled to say that it was unreasonable to use these kinds of steps in
the
first
place. So
if
you're using these kind of steps that wear out once a year, then even if you had every morning we inspect them, every hour we inspect them, you still say there's a jury issue. You could be found negligent on that.
Well, yes, there would be a jury issue. If they inspected them every morning and the jury found that they were using reasonable care, then they wouldn't be liable. So they are, back to your original question, they are not insured, depending upon...
But there is a there's a fact issue there.
There would be a fact
issue.
Using
this product that's less than a product than that which could be conceived, that is... That would be better.
Well, I think if you look at Resendez, for example, where this court in a per curiam opinion rendered judgment for the defendant, if the plaintiff is saying it's just negligent to have a self-service supermarket, at some point, the claim of negligence is, to put it bluntly, ridiculous. And the court can say there's no evidence. We're not going to let a jury say it is negligent to simply have a self-service supermarket. And the court did that in Resendez. But I don't think we're anywhere close to that case here. To say that you should use sturdy steps in a loading dock where there is constant use, heavy deliveries, refrigerators and things of that sort, I think is anywhere close to a claim where they're asked to be
insured. Getting close to product liability.
I'm sorry?
Isn't it getting close to injecting product liability in the proof?
Well, part of the requirement in a premises defect case is reasonable care to correct the defect. And the jury found that they did not use reasonable care.
I'm having a tough time here. You say they were not unreasonably dangerous when they were first installed, and if for up to 12 to 15 months, they weren't unreasonably dangerous.
We say they were unreasonably dangerous when they were installed because they couldn't be counted on. Let me give an example, if I could. Let's suppose that a movie theater or a mall or a sports arena puts tiles up on the ceiling, and they knowingly use an adhesive that is the improper adhesive to put those tiles up on the ceiling, either because of the heat conditions or the materials that are being used, and they know that. And they know, well, this will hold for about 6 months, and then it's going to start getting weak. According to CMH, they wouldn't have any duty to use the right tile until they knew that a particular piece of tile had become loose and was going to fall on someone. Right? So that's not making them insured. It's making them use reasonable construction on those tiles.
Using that hypothetical, what evidence is here? Well, let me start with merely the observation that over time the steps that are constructed need to be replaced. And the observation that by replacing them with full metal steps, they haven't had to replace for a couple of years. Does that satisfy the proof that, and using your hypothet, the owner knew that the glue was not appropriate for what they were using for? In this case, is that proof that these steps were a defective design for the purposes for which they were used?
Well, I agree. There has to be proof more than that it is the wrong glue. They have to either know or should know it's the wrong glue. Well, the evidence certainly supports a finding here by the jury that given the fact that they knew the steps wore out and they testified that they knew when the steps became wobbly, they were dangerous. They knew they had information from which a reasonable premises owner should have concluded they were using flimsy, shoddy steps.
Isn't part of the key here the wearing out process? I mean, if your tiles became loose and they were visible for a week that they were going to fall, they gradually sunk down and then they fell after they were weak, but that was visible, that might not be unreasonable. You just have to have, you know, at least once a week we inspect and look up at the tiles and see if they're loose. And here, similarly on these ladders, if they get wobbly for a period of time before they actually become unstable, isn't that a different situation than if this step appears to be in perfect working order 1 minute and the next minute you're crashing through?
Absolutely. That's a different issue, and the jury would be entitled to find under those circumstances that what they did was reasonable.
I'm not really talking about the jury being, you know, you're entitled to a jury trial, which you might win. I'm talking about what breaches the threshold to get to the jury.
Well, if this court is going to look at the individual facts of each case to determine whether something is reasonable or not, whether the practice of shoddy steps with inspection is reasonable, or should they have had better steps in the first place, the practice of using the right kind of adhesive for the tile in the first place, or instead of doing that, using an inspection, if the court is going to review every premises liability case, but this goes beyond premises liability, every tort case, to determine whether the particular choice by the defendant was reasonable, then every case is going to be reviewable. I think one of the most important things that this court has said about duty, and that's really what this case is about, the court should reverse only if there's no duty.
Don't we have jurisprudence and premises law that even if you know that there's an unreasonably dangerous condition on your property, you can satisfy your duty by either warning or frequent inspections to make sure?
Yes, absolutely. But whether the duty has been satisfied under the individual facts of the case is the breach issue. It's not the duty issue. The duty is to do what's reasonable.
But the breach is that you didn't. There was no breach of duty simply by putting the condition on the premises, as I understand our case law.
Well,
as long as you conditions or warn.
Well, in Corbin, the condition was the design, and the defendant wasn't able to come along and say, well, inspections are enough. Now, they could make that argument to the jury.
Well, weren't the facts, though, that inspections would not have made it safe because the grapes fell off so frequently?
Well, they could have had inspection. They could have had somebody standing by the grape stand. What the argument was inspections were unreasonable, and the jury was entitled to say that.
Well, let me ask you a question. You referred to the shoddy steps again. Does sound to me a bit like product liability. It puts something out there on the premises that it's the position of the plaintiff that the design was flawed. It seems to me that there has to be, if that's going to be the position, then the landowner either had to know or should have known about the design flaw. And the threshold proof for the plaintiff would be that the design was flawed. They'd have to prove that it was flawed, not that it wore out, not that it got wobbly after time, not that it had to be replaced periodically because of use, but that putting wood risers on metal frames in a dock situation like this is somehow fundamentally is an unreasonably dangerous condition. What does it take to do that?
When the proof is that the employees of CMH testified they knew this happened every time, or happened because trucks hit them. They knew it happened, and they testified that unstable steps were an unreasonable danger in the on the premises.
Didn't they also testify about wooden steps? I thought the petitioner made a big point in his brief, at least, that the only testimony about prior steps was that they were wooden, not that they were metal frame with wood, but that they were wooden.
The prior testimony is that this is what we did before the accident. And I think it's a reasonable inference from that testimony from which the jury could conclude that that was the condition in place before the accident.
Did they talk about wood steps or not?
Well, there was a lot of confusion as to whether steps were wood and metal or wood only. But the testimony of the CMH's own witnesses did not distinguish at all between we did it this way on some kinds of steps and did it another way on some other kinds of steps. It was generally, here's what we did before the accident. This was our practice, and I think it is a reasonable inference to infer that that was the situation in place.
Was there any direct evidence that the steps prior to these steps were wood-only steps?
No, but there was evidence that whether there were wood-only or wood and metal steps, that they became unstable. I'd like to come back to the way in a premises liability case or in a negligence case at all, the way the duty rule ought to work here.
Well, let me ask you this. What would be your position in that regard? If the evidence were, as it is here, that these steps became unstable after a period of time, 12 to 15 months, or let's say 12 to 15 months, and they had been installed
a week before. That was the evidence. Then what would your position on actual notice, what would you have to show to have actual notice?
Well, they still would know that these were bad kind of steps to use in this setting. And
that would be enough.
But that would be enough that they're bad kinds of, that if the steps are unreasonably dangerous. I'm not sure there would be proximate cause under those circumstances because the injury that happened was different than the one that we would expect to happen, i.e. the steps weren't out. So I don't think there would be liability there, but not because there's no duty or no defect, but rather because there's no proximate cause. But I'd like to come back.
How do we know the steps weren't installed the week before in this case?
We don't know one way or the other, but they have not challenged the proximate cause finding.
Why is the proximate cause? I didn't understand your answer to that last question. Why does that take it out of duty into proximate cause? Let's assume that it happened exactly the way it happened here. The plaintiff got out of the truck when he stepped on the steps, and he put in the week before, but nonetheless they were unstable and he was injured. Now, what makes that different from your case?
Well, as I took Justice Heck's question, that the reason these steps are dangerous is they're shoddy and you can't count on them to last. And if the injury wasn't caused by the fact that they didn't last, it might be
well,
a different
kind of
injury.
If we don't know how long they've been here now, how do we know that was the cause?
Well, the jury was properly instructed on proximate cause. The jury made a finding that there was proximate cause here, and it's never been challenged on appeal. I mean, I'd like to come prepared to answer the elements of the cause of action, but they have never appealed the proximate cause finding. And what I'm saying is, in response to Justice Heck, just because there's negligence or a premises defect doesn't automatically mean there's going to be liability. There are other elements of the cause of action.
But it does mean that you have proven notice.
Does mean you've proven notice.
You prove notice if you prove that the landowner knew that the steps eventually, at some point, could not be counted on.
Just like if somebody uses a wooden deck outside of a restaurant, they know they're supposed to use treated wood.
But it seems
right? They don't use treated wood, and it's dangerous. It's going to rot.
It seems to me if that's the case, then you really ought to use concrete steps out there.
That'd be one element. It turned out in this case, all metal steps would have solved the problem. So they had an easier way than using all concrete steps. And I would like to think at Sears, they did use
concrete steps. It sounds like a reasonable alternative design, which gets it back into the product.
But that's always a negligence. You're claiming the person should have done something different. That's always going to be a claim in negligence.
It seems clear then that you agree, obviously, with what the Court of Appeals says, that the Gonzalez case doesn't apply here. Sometimes.
Because the Gonzalez case is a different fact pattern for the same reason that Corbin is a different fact pattern. Gonzalez, the question was about that particular piece of macaroni salad, and the purpose of the notice requirement, the knowledge requirement, is so the defendant can do something about it. They can't do something about it until they know that particular piece of macaroni salad is on the ground. On the other hand, if the claim that we're making is they should have had different steps, then the notice requirement ought to go to, did they have notice that these were shoddy steps and could they have done something about it? And the proof here clearly shows that.
Well, but the argument in Gonzalez was also that you shouldn't serve macaroni in a store because you know it's going to get dribbled in the aisles.
Well, the Ron Hell case, by the way, that is the holding in the Ron Hell case. Now,
we rejected that argument, though.
Well, I don't think there was any proof in Gonzalez. Unlike Corbin, there wasn't any proof. The practice they were using was actually negligent. If the practice they were using, you know, they just watched it spill on the floor all the time and said, we don't care about it, then maybe it would have been a different case. I'd like to, in evaluating these cases, I think we do need to distinguish between the duty issue and the breach issue. What the jury can decide and what the court ought to decide. One of the most important things this court has said about duty was in Justice Heck's dissenting opinion in Reed. And that is, duty rules ought not be tickets for this day and train only. If they are, every single breach case, whether it's a premises case or a negligence case, is going to be a duty case that this court's going to have to review. Now, I understand we were on the other side in Reed. We thought that principle helped us in Reed rather than helped Kirby. But it's a crucial principle about the way duty works. It's the principle that we endorse in our casebook, it's the one in the judge and jury article, and it's the one, I think, that you quite properly endorsed in your dissenting opinion in Reed. This court ought not be simply looking at the facts of individual cases. Was inspection good enough here, or was cement steps good enough here? Was this tile adhesive good enough under these circumstances? That would turn every breach question into an ad hoc determination of duty.
Now, under your theory, we're going to turn every premises case into a did you use adequate building materials case.
Well, but if the question is did you use adequate building materials, what's wrong with that? Why not make the people that put tiles up on the ceilings or the people that build decks use reasonable building materials?
You use the comment on going back to the tile on the ceiling when they knew they had improper glue, but it seems to me under any type of structure on the premises, there's always a choice between a very expensive item that takes less maintenance, less repair, less replacement, and a cheaper item that requires more maintenance, more repair. More. It seems to me that the landowner runs the problem of taking on some liability for a defective premises without any notice that a particular item it needs to be replaced or is in repair simply because they bought an item that will have to be replaced or repaired at some point in time in the future. And whether they create a routine maintenance program or an inspection program because they know it will wear out or need to be maintained more often, even if they have that in place, it seems to me the duty rule there, though, creates a fact issue in every circumstance. As long as I could come forward and show there's a different product that would have lasted longer than this product does, I have now met the threshold of the duty obligation because they were aware that this would wear out.
Every time there's a duty, then the question is going to be, under the duty to act reasonably, did the defendant act reasonably? And that's going to be inherent in every negligence case. Duty can't do all of the work. It's an important concept, but it ought to be broad categorical rules. It ought not be, as Justice Heck has properly indicated, a ticket for this day and train only. If the question is whether the particular response to a known danger, and they've got that here, we've got a known danger that they knew these steps were unsuited for the purpose and that they were dangerous when they became wobbly. Whether the response that they made, be it inspection or better steps or better tiles or wood-treated decking that's going to be suffered by the weather, whether they made reasonable responses to it is the breach question. And if that becomes the duty question, every jury determination in every negligence case of whether somebody acted reasonably under the circumstances is always going to be, you should have behaved differently than you did. That's going to end up being a duty question if these duty rules are tickets for this day and train only. What we should have to prove to show the duty is to show that they knew about the danger of this condition. And the testimony shows that. They knew, as Justice Hankinson put it, these were shoddy, flimsy steps. They knew that. We're not making them an insurer. They knew that. They knew that they were dangerous because they were shoddy and flimsy.
Well, getting back to Justice Heck's question, if accepting everything you've said, if these steps were in their first week of installation, would there be a fact issue for the jury?
Well, in this case, just to clarify the hypothetical from this particular case, one of the dangers is where these steps were placed. They were placed where trucks had to back up over them routinely and could hit them and make them become unstable.
But there's no evidence that this happened before your client.
That's correct. There's no evidence as to why these particular steps became unstable.
Isn't that a factor that the Court of Appeals relied heavily on in reaching its decision in this case?
I think the Court of Appeals relied heavily on the fact that this was a bad design, just like in court.
Well, you say appellants knew that on a daily or perhaps hourly basis, trucks would back up right. The steps, creating a potential for damage to sink.
There are two ways these steps could become unstable. One, or not could become, did inevitably become unstable. One is they couldn't take the loads over a period of time, just like the tile falling or the rotted wood deck. The other is they were placed in a situation where the trucks would come and might hit them. I agree, we don't know which of those.
Well, then let it be a correct statement. You can't rely on that possibility as a reason to give constructive notice vis-a-vis your client's injury at a particular time, can you?
If the condition we're complaining...
Because that's the outside fortuitous event that the Court of Appeals says makes these cases...
I think that's exactly like Corbin. Exactly like Corbin. Because the way the great display was designed increased unreasonably the risk that people were going to fall without knowing that grape was on the floor. The way these steps were designed and where they were placed increased the risk unreasonably that people were going to get hurt on these steps, either because they were going to get hit by the truck or they were going to be flimsy and wear out over time. I think it's exactly like Corbin. And that's what the Court of Appeals was relying on.
Was there expert testimony that these steps were inappropriate for their intended use?
No. But...
But so it was just employees saying that they knew the steps could become unstable?
That not but could, but did. And they knew it was dangerous
well,
when they
became
unstable.
Well, now, I understand there was no evidence to show that the steps that were in use when the plaintiff stepped on them were the same as the ones that had become unstable.
I think that's a reasonable inference. I really do think that's a reasonable inference. That they testified, this is what we did before. If somebody comes in and
says...
But
you want to infer that the same steps were used?
I think that's an... I think it's a... Whatever steps were used, they were the kind that became wobbly. None of the testimony made any distinction. I think that's like saying, well, you said your practice was to use this bad adhesive, but we don't know exactly what adhesive you used on that particular piece of tile. I think that's a fair inference.
Well, can you summarize for me the evidence to indicate that these steps were inappropriate for their intended use? That would be employee's testimony that different steps had become unstable in the past?
Well, the steps that we used prior to the accident. Our practice was, and this is the supervisor and the two employees, Mr. Mason, Flores, and Gonzalez, testified, here's what we did. We used these temporary steps. We didn't secure them to the building or put them on a concrete pad or do anything else. We used these temporary steps. And our practice was, they get hit by trucks, they become unstable with roll mount. They'd wear out, they'd become unstable, and we'd throw them out. CMH clearly knew that these steps became dangerous. And what they're trying to say, just like the Tosh is, or just like in Corbin, we don't have any duty to do anything about that until we know that that event happened.
That's a very appealing argument if it were tried that way. I have the feeling it wasn't tried that way if there's not evidence that these particular steps, as defined, were not fit for the purpose for which they were used, and therefore... There was a dangerous condition. Apparently, whether they were anchored or not, was there testimony that this type should have been for this type of load?
But if it was a reasonable inference that steps that won't last under the load and steps that will get hit are improperly designed, I think that's a reasonable inference. If the question is, were we required to come forward with expert testimony on that, they could have objected to that at the trial. I don't think so, by the way. I think that's something within the purview of lay people. I think if a lay person went down to Sears and saw trucks making heavy deliveries of washing machines and things and using these little temporary steps, I think lay people would say, that's going to be dangerous. So I don't think it is necessary for expert testimony. But they never objected to us not having expert testimony.
Well, I'm not necessarily just saying expert testimony. I'm talking about more specific testimony about the nature of these steps versus other steps used in similar situations that would indicate these are...
Well, there is testimony there in the record that after this accident, they have used all metal steps, and over a 3.5 period between about a month after the accident and the injury, I'm sorry, and the trial, there were the steps had not become unstable. The witnesses said the new steps don't become unstable; the old ones did. So I think that comparison shows, you know, it's reasonable to use the metal steps. Now, whether concrete steps or fastening them to the building to make them secure, putting them on a concrete pad or something of that sort. There are other ways maybe that they could have been reasonable. But I think the jury could clearly infer there was a...
But we can't go into these others because we may have some Caterpillar versus Shears problems about whether that sets up its own set of problems. They have to be moved frequently and it's 150 pounds to move them and that can create back injuries. I mean, we can't really think about anything other than perhaps the metal steps that they used as a subsequent...
Well, we did argue, the testimony was they didn't secure them to the building, that they didn't put them on a concrete pad. They didn't use permanent steps. I think that's
and there's testimony in there that that would have been a reasonable alternative design that would set up any countervailing problems.
I think that's a fair inference that the jury can take from the fact that they've used flimsy steps. It's the same way if somebody walked down to Sears and saw these steps on the loading dock. I think that's a reasonable inference a jury can.
But somebody testified, had they secured them to the building or had they put them on a concrete pad, they would not have been unstable.
Well, I think it's a fair inference.
No, did somebody say that? Not
nobody said that. Nobody said that. And I'd like to come back to Shears if I could, Your Honor, in answer.
Not
your
my
question.
Favorite case, but
I understand. It's one of my favorites. We agree that the evidence has to support the duty rule, and there are no if the no duty rule obviates all of the factual questions, then there's no fact question to review. And in Shears, the duty rule was, for multi-purpose machinery, there was a general duty rule, not for a ticket for this day and train only. Or if there's something that's open and obvious to the ordinary consumer, it doesn't have to be warned against. Those are general no-duty rules. Our position, heaven knows that's what the judge and jury article is about. Our position is not that there ought not be such no-duty rules, but they ought to make sense and they ought to be supported by the evidence. This no-duty rule that they've got in their handout isn't supported by the cases. There's no case that's ever said that's the duty rule. It doesn't make sense given the notice requirement. The notice requirement is so people have a chance to do something to make the thing safer. They knew these were dangerous. They could have done something. We're not making them insurer in that regard. So duty rules are an important part of this court's jurisprudence to control what juries can do. But they ought not be tickets for this day and train only, because otherwise this court is going to review every jury determination on what was reasonable under the circumstances. They have not come, we've come forward with Corbin.
I think you're getting into our time. Is there another question?
Thank you. Your Honor.
Your Honor, I have 5 minutes. I'd like to make 3 points on rebuttal. First, let's start with the shoddy steps. They have made clear that what they are saying is that these steps were unreasonably dangerous from inception, that they were shoddy steps. What steps were these? These were the same kind of steps that the plaintiff's own company sold to consumers. Where is the evidence that these steps, which were metal, and the only part was wood, were of the same construction as the previous steps? You asked it multiple times. It was never answered. There is no evidence of that at all. That's a complete gap in their theory. Point two, and this is really the critical one. They say this case is Corbin. Read Corbin. This is not Corbin. Their argument would transform virtually every premises liability case into a Corbin case. Example, Justice Heck talked about actual notice. Their argument goes like this, and let's take Walmart v. Gonzalez. Is it foreseeable on some level that if you sell food on your premises, that some of it will end up on the floor occasionally? Answer, yes. If food is on the floor, is that a dangerous condition? Yes. Ergo, they say, you have actual notice of an unreasonably dangerous condition on your premises. No, that is not what Corbin says, and that's the distinction. What was it about Corbin that made it unique? It was that in that case, no amount of inspection, I mean, typically what happens, Walmart v. Gonzalez, yes, occasionally it falls, and for reasonable inspection, you scoop it up. Now,
what's
is there a risk of harm?
Reasonable? What's your evidence of reasonable inspection here? Once it's broken, you fix it.
Okay. And let me go back to the typical case. What we have with reasonable inspection is that over a course of time, 12 to 15 months, that these steps were monitored and used once or twice a day. I mean, that's the evidence that was done with respect to inspection.
How old were these steps here?
We don't know. But getting back to the point of, in the typical premises liability case, what is to incur is, sure, things fall on the floor, but we come through, we find them. Now, does that eliminate all risk? No. Is there a risk? No. And I think a case to look to on this is Camp. It's a decision by Justice Pope. The decision, it's 250 Southwest 2nd 413, 415. He has a series of quotes there. You know, danger is relative, and a person of ordinary care may incur some hazards. And they go on from there. This is what happened to Corbin. In Corbin, we did shift back to a situation where the man-made object, the mode of operation, was itself unreasonably dangerous. Why? Because no amount of inspection could reduce the risk of harm. Things were falling off, and they used that term so frequently that no amount of inspection could reasonably find it.
Why don't we have that here? If because of the way the steps were put up to the building, at any time a truck could hit them and cause them to become unstable.
Okay.
Why is that not analogous?
Well, because what we have there is, again, a potentiality that they're going to become unstable. But if you look at the seismic definition, and this is extremely important, the test is not might become unstable or inevitably become unstable. The test is probability of injury. And the experience out here, and this is one of the things that Chief Justice Calvert looked at in the Seidenick case, he says you look at, well, were there prior accidents there? And once again, we have to come back to actual or constructive knowledge. What had been the actual experience? Well, the actual experience here had been we use steps over time, and this is what happens in the real world. As man-made objects do, they would either wear out or be damaged, and if they were, we fixed them or got rid of them. And there have been no action.
Yes, one brief question. Third point. Breach. Very brief.
Third point. Breach. We do argue that there is no evidence of breach. In Corbin, the breach was there wasn't a map. Here they say, well, they didn't attach them to the walls, they didn't have the thing underneath, but there is no showing, and look at Leitch, Dovey Boys Club, no showing that any of those things would have made a difference.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
That concludes the argument, and the second call will take another group of sessions.
All right.